From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And in a few minutes, Netflix comes out against the Comcast-Time Warner merger and says it is hiking its prices. We'll have the details.
But first, a lot of news from the Supreme Court today. In a 6-2 ruling, the court upheld a voter-approved Michigan ban on race-based college admissions. We'll have reporting on that at hereandnow.org. But the justices are also hearing arguments on two other cases. In the first, an anti-abortion group is challenging an Ohio law that prohibits false statements about political candidates during campaigns. The group says that ban has a chilling effect on free speech. The second is a case that may shape the future of television. Here the question is, can a company, Aereo, capture TV broadcasts and then charge customers to see them but not make any payments to the broadcasters who produce the programs? Aereo has subscribers in 11 cities. Major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, say the answer to that question is no, because what they are doing is theft. Let's take that case up with Tom Taylor, editor at Bloomberg BNA, that's Bloomberg Bureau of National Affairs. He was in court today for these arguments, and we're reaching him on his cell phone just outside the court. So, Tom, start by telling us more about Aereo's business. We understand it depends on this very old technology, tiny antennas to gather things.
Yeah, so Robin, we are talking about an industry here, over-the-air broadcast television, that about 10% of America is still involved in. To be one of those people, I have the big, huge antenna top of my house. But that's not exactly what Aereo does. What Aereo does is they actually have these dime-sized antennas that they build into farms with thousands put together. They get over-the-air broadcast. They pick it up out of the air, and then they run it through a series of DVRs and other electronic equipment and stream it to subscribers over the Internet. So you can theoretically watch over-the-air broadcasts from, like you said, Fox, CBS, NBC, ABC, on your iPad, on your laptop, on your mobile phone, you know, with all the devices that we've all become accustomed to. So it's kind of taking an old technology and making it new again.
And by the way, speaking of technology, what we missed at the top with your cell phone there is you're saying this isn't like the antenna on the top of your house that people used to have to capture broadcasts. This is them building huge farms that capture the broadcast and then sell some of them to subscribers for $8 or $12 a month, but not pay anything to the broadcasters. So what does Aereo say to these charges that this is stealing?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly the argument that the broadcaster's making. Aereo's defense to that is we're not in the business of providing television content to anybody. They take the signal, that's correct, but what they're arguing is that they're actually equipment rental company. So they're basically saying, look, you don't want to go out and you don't want to stick an antenna on top of your house, or if you live in New York on an apartment, which is utterly more complex, you don't want to have to go out and buy the DVR, the sling box, everything you need to stream it over the Internet. We'll rent you your own personal equipment, allow you to do all this, and charge you $8 a month. So they try to avoid the whole idea of being a content company altogether.
Well, and they do this by pointing to a 2008 lower court ruling which allowed consumers to record programming through their cable. And they're also pointing back to, you know, the 1980s and the argument, the debate that was had over VCRs. So Aereo is saying, hey, we're just giving you, you know, the VCR and the tape that you record on. But is that really true? Because aren't they actually getting that material to the cloud for you? So they are actually pulling that programming out, which is different from back in the day when you just stuck your videotape in the machine and you recorded the TV program off your TV.
That's exactly right, and that's where there's, you know, it gets really nitpicky and really precise here. And basically the difference is what they're saying is the broadcasters on one side are saying, look, they're taking our content and retransmitting it. So they grab it and they send it to you. The difference, if you look at like the DVR or the VCR, is you as the consumer in your living room have installed an antenna or done whatever and grab that content yourself. So when you watch that recording on the DVR, you're only really transmitting it to yourself. It's a private transmission. What the broadcasters say is that in this scenario, Aereo is taking the transmission and then broadcasting it out to subscribers, which makes it a public transmission or a public showing, which is what they're saying is illegal under the copyright law.
Well, the networks are saying is if this happens, they're going to have to throw in the towel and just move to cable themselves and charge people. A lot of local stations, David Carr in the Times, New York Times, wrote a terrific column about how this is shaking up your local TV stations, this idea. But we know that the Supreme Court, you know, dismissed Sony's arguments, or rather dismissed the entertainment industry's arguments when Sony was the one defending its use of Betamax and VCRs years ago. How did this Supreme Court today seem to feel about Aereo's arguments? What did you pick up?
Well, there was two main points that were brought up, and there was they weren't necessarily conflicting, but Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Breyer kind of had two competing views that they were really interested in and wanted to talk about. I think Breyer's was the most important. Breyer was incessant that he doesn't understand what the consequences of the court's decision is going to be. And one example that the parties brought up to some great extent is cloud computing. There's an argument that a wrong decision by the court could greatly affect the cloud computing industry. So, you know, things like Dropbox and, you know, Google Drive and Amazon's cloud service and iCloud. And so there was this idea that the court didn't know exactly what the impact of its decision might be. And that worried the court, which tends to signal that they're going to look for the narrowest possible decision. And in fact, Breyer even considered, you know, should we kick this back to the lower courts without making a definite ruling, let them sort out all these issues and see if it comes back to us. So there was some great worry there. Roberts, on the other hand, was, you know, harping on this idea that this system of tiny antennas, all it's meant to do is to get around copyright laws. And, you know, so there's a question there, I think, in the court's mind of, are we really going to buy into this? Are we really going to sanction this when it's just a clear effort to evade copyright laws and what Congress has put down as legislation?
Boy, it's interesting. I'd love to be a fly on the wall when several of these Supreme Court judges are having coffee and saying, what's cloud computing again? Tom Taylor, editor at Bloomberg Bureau of National Affairs, on today's Supreme Court arguments. Thanks so much.
No problem, Rob. My pleasure.
Netflix has come out against the proposed $45 billion bid by Comcast to buy Time Warner Cable. For details, we're joined from New York by The Wall Street Journal's Jason Bellini. Jason, welcome back.
Thanks, Jeremy. Good to be with you.
Well, what did Netflix say about why they're opposing this deal now?
Well, first, this is becoming super interesting because, you know, until now, most media executives have been really reticent to oppose the deal between Time Warner and Comcast. So no one said very much about it while the regulators try to work it out. It's been smooth sailing. But then all of a sudden, as they release their first quarter results, Netflix comes out and they really bash this idea, saying that it's bad for net neutrality and that it's going to cost everyone when they have Netflix describes is, you know, a virtual monopoly when they've got coverage that is about 60% of U.S. broadband households.
They're saying it was bad for net neutrality. Comcast comes back and says, no, it would extend protection of net neutrality for millions of Americans.
That's exactly it. And I mean, the language they use that Comcast is using, I mean, it's really fighting words. They say in their statement on their website, they said Netflix is free to express its opinions, but they should be factually based and Netflix should be transparent that its opinion is not about protecting the consumer, about net neutrality. It's about improving Netflix's business model by shifting costs. And it goes on and on. But I mean, these are companies that huge media companies, and you don't normally hear in public them airing their grievances.
Well, and didn't the two of them, Netflix and Comcast, just make a deal back in February? They had to get together to provide faster and more reliable access to Netflix for Comcast subscribers.
That's exactly right. They were playing nice just a few months ago. Netflix made a deal with Comcast, and what that did was it gave Netflix a direct connection to the broadband aspect of Comcast. So that bypasses the bandwidth providers and makes streaming of movies faster. Netflix has said that streaming speeds to Comcast users have increased by 65% between January and March. So there's a big benefit there to Comcast users. And so they paid handsomely for that. But it really broke a barrier when you had a provider paying for, you know, content provider paying for that access to be able to get their content out there. Whereas, you know, until now, you know, if YouTube, everyone else, when they're producing content, they don't have to pay to get it to you through your cable company or anyone else.
But it does bring up a question about who's holding the cards here, because you can't get Netflix without some kind of internet service, and most people who have internet service, or many people anyway, are getting it through their cable subscriber.
That's exactly right. And you know what Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, said is that he had no choice when their company agreed to pay Comcast for that deal that we were just discussing, because really Comcast cable system has, that's the only way that they can ensure good quality video streaming. And they're concerned, as they say in their statement, that now this is going to create an anti-competitive leverage. That was the terminology they used for Comcast as this gigantic media company that, again, 60% of households will be getting their broadband through them.
One more thing, Jason. Netflix also said at the same time as they came out against this merger that they're going to raise their prices for new customers. Tell us what they're doing.
They're going to raise their prices for new customers by a couple bucks a month. A dollar or two a month is what they say. And so far, the reaction has been fairly positive. Their stock has been up. This is in contrast to the fiasco they had back in 2011. That's when they said they were going to boost their DVD and online video package to $16 a month from $10 a month. And people fled. The stock just tanked. It was a really awful situation. This time they're doing it much more gently. They're saying that it's not going to affect current subscribers immediately, but they need the money because they're investing it in creating original content, spending billions of dollars to create popular shows that are doing so well, and it's making them the largest subscriber-based service in the country.
Yeah, shows like House of Cards, Orange is the New Black, they probably have a lot more leverage with their customers now when they're producing shows like that. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal, thanks as always.
Thank you.
President Obama heads to Asia tomorrow. His first stop is Japan, but he will also visit South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The trip comes amid uncertainties in the region about the president's commitment there, but it also coincides with reports from the South Korean Defense Ministry that North Korea might carry out another underground nuclear test, possibly while President Obama is in the region. Jim Walsh is with MIT's Security Studies Program. He joins us in the studio. Jim, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Is it possible that North Korea would actually do a nuclear test while President Obama is there on the peninsula?
I think it's possible. I think most experts that have been debating this past month, because data started showing up a month ago and satellite reconnaissance photos, think it could happen, but that's unlikely. They'd have to really move things along. On Friday, not only will the president be arriving, but also it is a day in the North Korean calendar, the sort of Army Day. But, the way I look at this stuff is it's going to happen. You know, they announced some time ago, at least Kim Jong-un, made reference to the fact that there was going to be tests. And folks have been talking, or the North Koreans have been talking about a different kind of test they plan to do in the future. So whether the future is Friday or the Friday after that or next month, I think it's going to happen.
But what do they have to gain from doing that, especially if it happens while President Obama is there?
I hear you on that. And I think we often focus on why would North Korea do this vis-a-vis us? But there are other things going on, too. So there are domestic things. You'll remember when they had one of the highest ranked officials executed a while ago, you know, intrigue in the palace. So sometimes you do stuff because you have a domestic audience, or sometimes there are other players in the region that matter to you more than the United States. And this cuts both ways, because the last thing China wants is for them to test. So there are pressures for them probably internally to test. And meanwhile, China, their biggest patron, is telling them, please don't test.
Would the U.S. have to respond if they did carry out a test?
You know, I think we're just going to see more of the same. And we've been in the cycle a long time now where we have provocation followed by resolutions and naval exercises, military drills, and around it goes. So they say they need to show that they're strong in the face of U.S.-Korean military exercises. And then after they do something, we say we have to respond to their provocation. And we've been at this now for a little while.
We talked to the BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Tokyo about this and asked him what the reaction would be there if North Korea does do a nuclear test while President Obama is in the region. Here's what he said.
Well, with a great deal of disquiet from the U.S. government, from the Japanese and from the South Koreans. But it is exactly the sort of display that you would expect from the North Koreans. It would draw a lot of attention to them at a time when the focus of the world is on this region. We are guessing to a certain extent. There apparently is movement at the site where they do their nuclear tests. But I don't think anybody would be surprised that North Korea would attempt this sort of thing right at this moment.
Jim Walsh, it doesn't seem like any sanctions that have been put on North Korea have done anything to deter them from this kind of behavior.
Yeah, well, you saw that UN panel report, experts group report, came out a little while ago on the sanctions and essentially arrived at your conclusion, Jeremy. I would say if you step back and look at it from 30,000 feet, it's really an issue of geography. The U.S. is blessed when it comes to geography. Why? We're surrounded by two big oceans and two big weak neighbors. The other country that won the lottery here was North Korea, because they are sitting smack dab next to the biggest growing economy in the world. So if you happen to be right next to it, you know, if North Korea and South Korea switched positions and North Korea was separated with a border from China, well, it'd be in a lot worse shape. But it's next to a really, really big, growing, robust economy.
Put this in the context for us of what is going on elsewhere in the world. In Syria, I'm thinking of the red line that the Obama administration put out there about chemical weapons. It was crossed. There wasn't the kind of response that many people would have thought that there would be. And now what's going on in Ukraine with Russia? Let's listen here to Senator Bob Corker, the Republican from Tennessee, talking about exactly that, the Russian situation and the situation in Syria.
The wisest thing that Assad did really was to kill 1,200 people with chemical weapons, because in essence we said, don't embarrass us any more that way. You can go ahead and kill another 60,000 people with barrel bombs and by other means, but don't embarrass us. And I think that's what we're saying to Russia today by the actions that we're not taking. Don't embarrass us, but you can continue the black ops activities. You can continue the other things that you're doing.
Senator Bob Corker speaking on Meet the Press. Jim Walsh, what do you make of that?
Well, I like Bob Corker, and I have a lot of respect for him as a senator. I think he's, you know, wandering off a little far on this. I'd be curious to see what his recommendation would be. You know, so you don't like this happening. What exactly would you have the U.S. do? Now, with respect to Syria, there have been two big developments this week, one good, one bad. The U.N. came out and said they've destroyed 80% of Assad's chemical weapons. You know, that's pretty big. That's more than we would have gotten through a military strike had we done that back in September, that Labor Day weekend. Now, if you get 80% of 500 metric tons of chemical weapons, that still leaves, you know, 100 metric tons.
Yeah.
You're right. So obviously, no one wants a civil war to continue, but, you know, if Assad is intent on killing his population, he's going to kill them one way or another. But that doesn't mean it isn't a good thing to get, you know, 400, maybe all of those chemical weapons out of there.
But there's also a report this week about chlorine gas attacks by the Assad regime. That was not one of the chemicals on the list of chemicals. So, but it can still kill people.
Absolutely. And, you know, machetes can kill people and lots of things can kill people. Now, you know, chlorine gas is one of the, there are a lot of industrial agents that we would use. We would use chlorine to wash swimming pools or to do different things. Well, you can take those industrial agents, but if you spray people with them, they're deadly and they're toxic. But I think we also have to put it in some context here. Sarin gas, way more toxic and deadly, can kill a lot more people. Mustard gas, all the way along. So it's good that we're getting these things out of here. My guess is, the first priority is to get the rest of it out, and you're not going to see a big response from the U.S. or from France or from others to this reported use earlier this month. They're going to probably try to get job one done, which is to get them all out of there or destroyed, and then turn their attention back to Assad.
But Bob Corker's point being, even this is not about chemical weapons. This is about somebody killing his people, and the United States is standing by and letting that happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are a lot of terrible things that happen all over the world, and there are lots of civil wars. And I think, you know, there's this old joke, you know, that among strategists, security strategists, don't get involved in a land war in Asia and don't get involved in a civil war. Now, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. But what exactly are we going to put U.S. boots in the ground? What are we going to what are we going to do that's fundamentally going to change that outcome at some reasonable cost to us? We can't spend everything we have to stop it. And what's our likelihood of success?
What about in Ukraine? Should the United States be getting involved to a larger degree than it is right now?
You know, I think the Russians care more about Ukraine than we do. You know, and someone, I sort of wonder, when we're a year out from now, like you'll remember in 2008, they invaded and took part of Georgia. you know, a year from, which no one talks about, no one, you know, sort of everyone forgets that. A year from now, is Russia really going to be happy that they've done what they've done? I mean, essentially what they'll do is they'll leave Ukraine, the western part of Ukraine, which is going to be intensely anti-Russian, right? And they've taken all the pro-Russian people off the table. Now they're part of Russia. And you see stories today about Crimea having all sorts of problems. They're disorganized. They don't have a functioning government. If they take, you know, part of eastern Ukraine, you know, what's going to happen? I think already $80 billion has fled Russia. So it's not clear that this is a big thing to the U.S., should be a big thing, or that we should pay high costs for it.
Well, and the question will be, will Russia change its tune at all if sanctions get bigger than they are from the West, from the United States? Jim Walsh with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
As Vice President Biden continues his visit to Ukraine, the tension continues in the eastern part of the country, where pro-Russian militants have taken over buildings and refused to give them up. The BBC's Natalia Antolava reports from Lugansk, one of the strongholds of the pro-Russian movement.
That's the Lugansk protest camp ahead of us, so we'll go and see what the mood is like. This feels like a proper tent city, a lot bigger than the one in Donetsk. We now have a guide, so we're going to be taken around. Простите, ваше имя? Олег. Олег. So this Олег, our guide, is going to take us around. Says we're well armed. The armed forces are inside. И сдавать вы их не собираетесь? Of course, we won't give up the weapons. Олег is just saying that he'll get at least 10 years in prison if he changes his mind now, because they've now been called separatists and terrorists. So I asked about the amnesty that the Ukrainian side has signed up to in Geneva. He just doesn't believe it. He says they're promises. Why should we trust them? So it really doesn't look like Geneva has had any effect on Lugansk, because Oleg is saying that they are preparing for the referendum, which will ask people here whether they want to have a greater autonomy or join Russia, and they're still planning to have it on May 11th. I was just eavesdropping on this lady's telephone conversation, and she says, well, it's not going to be any better in Russia for us, is it? We need a greater autonomy. We don't need to be part of Russia. So opinion, even here at this square, opinion is divided.
Do we look like terrorists to you? Have you watched Ukrainian TV? Have you seen what they say about us? We are the terrorists?
If we need to, we'll turn into them, because my homeland is right here. I used to think the whole Ukraine is my homeland, but I was wrong.
Russia knows. If we don't defend Ukraine here, they're going to get their own revolution in Moscow. That's why they will help us.
Как вы видите выход из этой ситуации? В чем? I'm asking, what's the solution to all of this? To this deadlock? I'm a Ukrainian, I'm a Russian, I'm a Slav. I'm not a European. My soul isn't European. Let us go home, he says. The really incredible thing is that everyone I've ever spoken to in Kiev thinks that everybody here is completely brainwashed. Everyone I'm speaking to here thinks everybody in Kiev is totally brainwashed.
That's the BBC's Natalia Antolava reporting from Ukraine.
Thought exercise for you now. Imagine the ancient Greek philosopher Plato in the U.S. today on a book tour. It could happen. The most influential philosopher in Western history. How influential? Well, one modern authority said the last 24 centuries of philosophy consists of a series of footnotes to Plato's dialogues, in which he took up questions like, what is love? Should society censor art? What's the best form of government? What would he make today of a PR agent, of Google? How would he weigh in on the great debate launched by Tiger Mom Amy Chua on raising children? What would Plato teach us and learn from us? These are the questions philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein explores in her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. We invited her in to spend a few minutes here today. So, Rebecca, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here.
What a hilarious idea. Have Plato be on a book tour. Plato, creator of philosophy as we know it, at the knee of Socrates. Remind us who he was.
Who they were, yes. Yeah. So Socrates was a kind of gadfly. He was a sort of philosophical urban gorilla hanging around in the middle of Athens, asking these peculiar questions of everybody, important people, young men, slaves, questions that had to do with, ultimately, what's the life that's worth living? And Plato was one of the young men who hung around him, a very aristocratic young man, came from a very old, important family. And Socrates was put on trial on the capital charges of impiety and corrupting the young. This was in 399 BCE, found guilty by his 501 jurors. And then he was supposed to plea bargain with them. And he ended up so infuriating them that more people voted for him to die than had voted for his guilt. And he was executed.
Put to death.
He's put to death, yeah. You know, we so often speak as if the ancient Greeks were all philosophers. Right? They were all so committed to reason. It's very important to remember that the philosophers were social dissidents. They were social critics.
Right.
The man in the street or woman in the street did not particularly cherish what they said. Socrates was killed.
Well, and Plato picks up where he leaves off and takes his dialogues, these Socratic questions that he would ask, crazy questions in a lot of cases, but these questions that would get these dialogues going. And Plato, as we said, creates philosophy as we know it. So you bring him to today.
Yes.
Why, first of all?
As a way of demonstrating the persistence of the questions that he asked, not necessarily the answers. And one of the things I want to do in bringing him back is to demonstrate how far we've come. It's something that's very often said, that philosophy, as opposed to science, never makes any progress. Well, my Plato, when he comes back, is constantly being astounded, not just by the science and technology that we've learned, but by the ethical knowledge, the political knowledge. You know, what? No slaves? Right? That never occurred to anybody in the ancient world,
right,
that slavery was an abomination.
Well, you imagine him on a speaking tour, chaperoned by his media PR escort, Cheryl. She gets into an amazing debate with him. It's over personal freedom and whether people are really equal, but it starts with an analogy with orthodontia. How?
Yes. In the dialogues, and of course, Plato wrote in dialogue forms, and he often used these very homely analogies. It's about farmers, or it's about sheep shearers, or, you know, so these most abstract and lofty ideas, but put in the language of very down-to-earth metaphors. And so I gave him a modern one, orthodonture.
Okay, relate that to personal freedom.
Well, the question became whether or not there are philosophical experts. And this was a contentious debate in Plato's own day. Are there experts, ethical experts? That's very offensive to all of us, because it's part of our humanity to have a stake in these questions, to feel that we ourselves know the difference between right and wrong. And then along come these experts, philosophers, yeah, claiming, you know, an expertise, a special training, a special skill, a special talent. And that's where that that analogy to orthodonture comes in, that Plato there is arguing that, look, if you have crooked teeth, you take them to an expert who knows how to straighten your teeth. Well, if you have a crooked life, it's very hard for you yourself to judge that. Maybe you need an outside expert, and that's where philosophy comes in.
But a Google engineer argues that Google has changed all of that.
Yes, yes. He has the idea that crowdsourcing could answer these ethical questions, and he comes up with this, I think, fairly ingenious idea of a search engine. He calls it the Ethical Answer Search Engine, and these questions could be answered with ease. That's the acronym of his search engine. And Plato was able to throw a monkey wrench into this idea.
That,
he
yeah.
does demolish it. And often what I try to do, I memorized all 26 of the dialogues so that I would know passages that Plato had actually written that were relevant to our debate, so wow. I could weave them in. Actually, I'm still tweeting as Plato because I just hear him constantly. I read something. I'm always trying to weave in actual words of this 2,400-year-old man.
Could you give us a little bit from his dialogues and then from the words you actually gave him in your book to demonstrate to us how he did demolish that argument?
Yeah. Basically, he actually uses what he's learning from us, which is that we've made a lot of progress, that there have been ethical reformers who went against the grain, and they proposed ideas that we couldn't arrive at through crowdsourcing because they were new.
They were outliers.
So yeah. When, you know, the first people started to argue against slavery, for example, this was a new idea. If you crowdsourced, you'd never come up with this. Yeah. And so exactly the kind of progress we've made couldn't be made if we depended on crowdsourcing. Huh.
Philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. By the way, if you'd like to follow Plato on Twitter, who knew? Okay, it's her. It's at Plato Book Tour. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
If you've just tuned in, welcome. We're talking Plato and philosophy, and it's fun because it's filtered through the imagination of MacArthur Genius Award winner Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, who in her new book takes Plato on a modern-day book tour. The book is Plato at the Googleplex. Let's pick up where she has Plato as part of an author's panel at New York's 92nd Street Y, debating child-rearing with two other authors, one Sophie Z., who sounds suspiciously like Tiger Mom Amy Chua, only Sophie Z's book is called The Warrior Mother. The other author represents those old-school European-born child psychologists who say parents should do nothing to shape their children, let them discover themselves. And by the way, Rebecca Goldstein, you named that author Dr. Mitzi Munitz. Who is she supposed to represent?
I don't know.
You made her up.
She kind of, you know, I think it started as a kind of Melanie Klein figure, and I had read a lot of Melanie Klein many, many years ago. And so I had begun by having her in my mind, but it's somebody who has a very strong sense of a child's autonomy.
Right, and let them become their own person.
Yes.
Well, and where does Plato come down with these two extremes?
It's interesting, and they actually give Plato a hard time because, you know, I think Plato's position is somewhat difficult. You know, everybody is struggling to refine their views in opposition to the other people. And I think that's one of the most important things that philosophy actually has to teach us, that you have to air your views and bring them to the table with people with whom you disagree very much. Plato does talk a great deal about recognizing the characteristics of the exceptional child and of training it, of subjecting it to something far beyond the warrior mother or the tiger mother. And he gives us this program in the Republic for everything from what kind of bedtime stories they should be allowed to read, the balance between sports and music, and all sorts of things that actually the tiger mom talks about. But he is trying to train exceptional children, not just for the sake of, you know, having exceptional children. We all want our children to be exceptional, but so that they will be the perfect leaders of his utopia, so ethically developed that we can trust them with all of this power. So it's really a political question that he's answering there. Sophie Z in my dialogue, you know, she just thinks, you know, it's the responsibility of every parent to produce an off-the-charts child. And when Plato says, look, that's just not possible, that the children have very, very different talents, she says, well, then it's an immoral universe. Here you are saying, Plato, that the unexamined life is not worth living. And if it takes tremendous philosophical sophistication to live the examined life, are you telling me that some of our children can't live a life worth living? And that is actually, I think that's a very important question to ask Plato.
And does he shift at all? Does he learn
anything? There's a certain opening, but over the course of the book, I think he becomes a little more flexible on this issue. One of the interesting things about the ancient Greeks is that they really didn't have our conception of individual rights. They didn't have our conception of all lives mattering. It really was true for them that certain lives mattered a lot more than others. It didn't dawn on them that all lives, although different, can be lives of equal mattering. And that is actually something, a huge ethical lesson that's taken us millennia to learn, and it's still going on. We're still wrestling with this question, expanding the boundaries of the lives that matter, trying to erase the inequities that exist across the globe. That is something that we really have still to learn, but certainly to teach the ancient Greeks.
Well, it is all here. One of my favorite allegories of Plato's is the allegory of the cave.
Yes.
The people chained in a cave, facing away from the opening of the cave to the wall behind, on which they're watching this shadow puppet show. They're looking at the shadows on the wall instead of the real world behind them, until one escapes and tries to tell them, you're only looking at the shadows on the wall. I love that. It applies so, I'm not the first to say this, but it just applies so to technology today and how we're always looking at our screens and the shadows on the wall, and we're not looking at the thing outside the door.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you use it?
It is one of the most powerful metaphors that come from the history of philosophy. And, you know, for Plato believed in our being able to make philosophical progress. For him, this is a metaphor of making philosophical progress. When he has Socrates say, when he first paints this picture of everybody chained there so they can't even turn their heads and see the puppets, much less the world that exists outside the cave, and they're just staring at shadows and they're studying the shadows, they're expert shadowists. One of the respondents, actually it's Plato's brother, says, that's a strange picture you're painting. And Socrates says, it's of us. That's the way we are. And for him in particular, for Plato, it was a picture of our ethical knowledge, that we are all prisoners of ideology. Plato was trying to break the bonds of Athenian ideology, of Athenian exceptionalism, and saying, look, you really haven't even begun to consider this question of what it is to live a life that's worth living.
You're only looking at a shadow of something that you already know.
Exactly. So dogma, doctrine, unexamined assumptions, that's what it is to be sharing at these shadows. No way of grounding it to reality. He uses a word, a Greek word, akasia, which means ungrounded. It's where we're just cut off from reality. Unless we can argue, we can substantiate, we can justify, we can convince each other.
You can listen to the guy who snuck out and said, hey, there's something over here.
Exactly.
Gosh, so he wasn't talking about big screen TVs?
No, but we sure can apply it.
Rebecca, your book comes after a very intense debate in the New Republic a while back between your husband, Harvard linguist and cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, and Leon Wieseltier, your husband writing a plea from science to the humanities saying science is not your enemy, Leon writing, now science wants to invade the liberal arts. It's essentially a debate who really has all the answers to the big life questions, science or ancient understanding. Put that debate aside, although it was juicy. What are you saying?
Philosophy is this amazing technique we've devised for getting reality to answer us back when we're getting it wrong. Science itself can't make those arguments. You actually have to rely on philosophy of science. I mean, for example, does everybody have equal rights to a life of full flourishing? You know, I would say that philosophy slowly has given us arguments saying, look, you're already committed to your own life flourishing. You're being inconsistent if you don't expand it. So philosophy often works in trying to show us that there's an inner incoherence in our points of view. We're committed to one thing when it comes to us and our own kind, but we're not willing to expand it, and we're guilty of inconsistency. That's a kind of trick that Socrates and Plato use over and over again. It's really very characteristically a philosophical technique. It's not that kind of empirical testing. It's arguing for inner coherence. But that we can make progress using that. We have made progress using that.
That's philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. Her ingenious new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, in which she puts Plato on a book tour in the U.S. hilarity ensues. Rebecca, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you. It's so much fun to be with you.
And Jeremy, I'm looking at some of Plato's tweets from his book tour. Here he says, you know, I follow Aristotle, but he doesn't follow me back. A severe case of anxiety of influence, I'd say. Again, you can follow him, her, at Plato Book Tour. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.